a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go. Episode 290, end of the week. Happy Friday to everyone. So I have a special treat for you today, and I know what you're thinking. No, not Chris' special treat, Stefanik. A different special treat. I am here today with Jeremy Rivera of Little J Marketing. Is that right?
That's right.
All right, Jeremy, welcome to The Counterposition.
Hey, it's good to be here, Andrew. Thanks for having me, man.
So it's funny, this
Chris
show,
and I couldn't be any more different. So
you and Chris are actually kind of similar. Chris off the record is a lot more like you.
I'm just kidding.
He's a big Catholic face, so he has to be a little more controlled than we do.
God bless him.
I love Chris. I mean, Chris, if you're listening, which I know you're not because you're too busy, but
you know who I'm a big fan of though?
Who's that?
Do you know Annie Hickman? Annie, E-N-N-I-E, Hickman. He's I'm like a fan of Annie Hickman. I've been following him. We spoke at a conference a couple years ago, a Steubenville conference in St. Louis, and ever since then, he's like my favorite Catholic celebrity.
I've never even heard of him.
Annie Hickman? Adore Ministries? Come on, man.
Okay, dude, I exist. For where I work and stuff, I exist outside of the Catholic bubble.
Okay.
I'll tell you a quick story. So I moved here to Denver. I share a best friend with Stefanik, right? So him and Nat used to come to California and hang out with my friends and their family, bring a couple kids with them, go. We'd hang out, barbecue, drink a bunch of wine, play guitar, talk about theology till 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. Just this guy, that dude from Denver that comes. Okay, yeah. He's friends with Justin. So I moved to Denver and I'm like, oh, hey, that Chris guy lives here. So I get the number. I call him up. Hey, what's up, man? Yeah. So we start hanging out, you know. And about the third or fourth time that I tell someone, I thought he was like a youth minister or something. I didn't know.
Right.
So
isn't he a youth minister?
He kind of is. Yeah. But he's on a big scale. Right. So about the third or fourth time that I say, yeah, I was telling Stefanik at dinner the other night. And someone goes, you go to dinner at Chris Stefanik's house? I'm like, yeah. Like the fourth time that happened, I call Chris up. Hey, Chris. Hey, what's up, man? How's it going? Hey, I'm starting to get the feeling that you're kind of a big deal. And he says, I don't know what to tell you this, but I'm kind of a big deal. He starts quoting Anchorman. I have many leather bound books and my apartment smells of rich mahogany. And so I'm like, I Google him while he's on the phone. And I'm like, oh, dude, you're like freaking famous. He's like, well, I'm like Catholic famous, right?
It's too funny.
But I exist outside the Catholic bubble. I would have known someone like Rob Bell or somebody before I would have known like someone like Chris Stefanik.
Well, it is kind of a subculture of a subculture.
But I mean, he's giant though.
Oh, he is. I'm saying that whole.
See, we talk about him because I can't get him back on the show because I can never get him to slow down long enough to come on the show. He's been on a couple times, but.
Right.
So Jeremy, let's quit talking about it. Dude, who cares about Chris Stefanik? Shut up, Chris.
You gotta also get to know Annie. He's really cool.
Annie.
E-N-N-I-E Hickman. Look him
so
up
what's
online.
His, like,
he's just a cool
his
dude. He's just a very real, authentic, another one of these brothers who, incredible communicator and a family man. I think he's got 6 or 7 kids, lives in Houston, runs Adore Ministries. I'm not even sure why I'm talking about him other than the fact that, you know, when you cross somebody's path who, you know, is seeking, you know, God in a very real way and doesn't care too much about what people think.
Right.
I like that. And I think that he's a pretty powerful voice.
Well,
we
don't have Chris Stefanik. We don't have any Hickman. We have Jeremy Rivera, ladies and gentlemen. And I want to know about you.
Right on.
Okay. So Jeremy, you have this thing, Little J.
Yep.
Tell who are you? What are you doing here?
So I am a husband, a father, Denver native, living here in my home state. But I went away to California and Hawaii for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I run a creative agency. It's a marketing agency called The Little J. The J is kind of reminds me of The Little Way. And also kind of like it's all lowercase. So it's a little more it's supposed to have more humility to the message. And the J is for Jesus. So. Just kind of, I would say about 50% of my clients are Catholic and 50% are secular. And so we offer, you know, creative services such as like branding and design work and video production and inbound marketing.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I've been doing that for about 5 years. I was the former national marketing director for Focus. I was at Focus for 8 years.
Oh, okay. Before
launching my own little company. And yeah, I live here with my wife and kids. And
so, you know, my friend slash partner occasionally in crime, John Leindecker. Then.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We're close.
Talk about a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. Man. I love that guy. His beard is the force to be reckoned with.
I'm catching up. I'm catching up with John. I'm coming for you.
We recently just did I don't know how you say that the right way, but we were both speaking at an event in Aspen, this fall, I think. Yeah. Past fall. It's so fun to just be with John and share. And that was a bit,
I'll tell you what, I went out to his house, when I was visiting my friend that teaches at Xavier, and, we went over to the house for dinner, had a big old barbecue. And I kind of knew him a little bit from here, but kind of more, we were acquaintances here, but we'd gotten to be friends kind of over Facebook. And then when I came out, like we went and hung out. And I tell you what, we had a blast that night. Much barbecue was eaten. An adult beverage or two was consumed. And I have never seen anything more beautiful than it's bedtime. And I'm a single guy. And so I've been at a lot of observed from the outside, a lot of bedtime rituals with families that I'm friends with hanging out. And he's like, I could kill you bedtime. Kids, get down here, kids. You know, they all come down. And all these kids seeing the Byzantine night prayer from memory. And then they get in a line, like you're going to communion or something.
They get a blessing.
And they get a blessing from dad. I mean, I was sitting there.
That's cool.
Several glasses of wine and a lot of barbecue in, just like tears welling up. I'm like, that is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Nothing will make you cry more than barbecue.
Barbecue and John Leindecker.
That's awesome, man. He's an amazing brother.
So you're over Focus. Now, it's funny. I just want to back up for a second. This show is called, I want to connect this to the show, because the show is called The Counter Position, which is kind of a play on words. I don't think people half the time realize it's a play on words. It's my take on the world from my position, which for 23 years has been behind the counter. Like I grew up in my dad's shop behind the counter. I have been in the coffee industry for like 23 years and worked in restaurants and stuff. So that position of service in hospitality and all of that kind of random conversation that happens. And you and I actually met and bonded initially in that exact context. That's right? You're another guy that I met over the bar. Yep. You're like, hey, what are you doing here? Hey, what's going on? And we start talking.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, we're like two cups of coffee in and like, you know, it finishes your sentences, you know.
Here we are.
Yeah, so there you go. So that's, but not like I need that reason to bring someone on the show. But so, all right. So you were
Focus
for 8 years. Now I want to get to the situation before that, before you were at Focus, because you have a pretty interesting story about how you ended up at Focus and places like that. How you ended up a Catholic. And I think let's talk about that. Let's talk about,
sure.
You were raised Catholic.
Yeah, right? I was raised Catholic. But you know, very, very, culturally Catholic. I guess.
Me too.
You know, my mom would make us go to church on Sundays, but I actually got kicked out of confirmation my junior year in high school for being a little too divisive, asking tough questions, not so that I could seek to understand, but so that I could kind of be right.
Dude, I got thrown out of catechism. I got thrown out of catechism.
Yeah.
And I was right, for the record. I can now defend completely what I said. And the priest and the nun that threw me out were, in fact, wrong. They needed to read their canon law a little better. I asked a question, and now, after my entire theological education, I look back on that, and I was like, yeah, I was a little crap about it, but they should have said, actually, yeah, good distinction. You're right about that. Mm-hmm. They hadn't read their Aquinas. I win. I win, Father Ambrose Strotman, wherever you are, probably in heaven or a Pronobius, but I win.
So yeah, I grew up in the church, and then as soon as I graduated from high school, I went off to CU Boulder, which, if you don't have a whole lot of formation and you go to CU and you're a very insecure 18-year-old still who hasn't found themselves.
It's a very intellectual school. A lot of people with pipes and patches on blazers.
I was more of the
I'm kidding. It's jock, like it's a party school.
More of the jock partier, you know. And so I joined fraternity, and that just led to a lot of suffering and turmoil rather quickly.
Oh, wait, but you're a frat boy?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, that's it. This interview's over. You should have disclosed that in the pre-interview.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you're over at CU, man. There's been a lot of good. The frat boy party scene, or the party kid scene at CU has been pretty good to us. The Denver Catholic scene. I mean, think about Father John Nepple.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. You. Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of good dudes come out of that scene. It's a good place to figure out that's empty.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of people can't party as hard as they can there, dude.
But that was where I really had my conversion. You know. All that partying led to a pregnancy.
Oh, wow.
And to someone I really didn't know, and she had an abortion.
Oh, that's brutal.
And but it was in that time frame that I really, you know, reached out to God. I remember just praying on my knees in my dorm room. It was the first time in my life I really needed God to be real. And man, you know, I went back to Mass. And there just wasn't anybody there. The priest didn't have time to meet with me. There was no focus at the time. There was nothing. And that was all I knew. And so God brought these evangelical Protestants out of the woodwork to just reach out to me. It was crazy, you know. So I ended up going to Bible studies and their church services. And really it was that time that really brought me into an encounter with Jesus through the scriptures. And it was Romans. Was Romans, I forget the verse, but basically that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. That was the verse that brought me
back.
And
there's the thing is like, that is, I think that verse is key to a ton of stuff, especially a lot of these social issues and stuff in the church. So let's go to the break. And when we get back, we're going to dive farther into this conversion story, because I've heard some of this and this is spectacular. Chappie makes an appearance. It's a good time. All right. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I'm here with Jeremy Rivera. We'll be back in just a second. See you on the other side.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, we are still here with Jeremy Rivera of Little J. And when last we left our hero, he was at CU partying and things got out of hand. So you had, I didn't know this part of your story. Yeah. So all that partying and CU ended up with a girl getting pregnant. She had an abortion. Mm-hmm. That'll wake you up quick.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Especially because of
that gets real. That's real stuff.
It kind of unearthed the sacramental deposit that was made through the faith of my mom. Looking back on it now, like God bless my mom for, even though she wasn't formed in the faith, she had enough conviction and commitment to get my brother and I to Mass every Sunday.
Now, before this happened, if I'd have walked up to partying frat boy Jeremy Rivera and said, hey, what do you think about abortion? What would you have said before?
I have no idea.
You don't even remember?
No, yeah. No, but I do know I would have punched you in the face if you would have dissed the Catholic Church.
Really?
Yep, even pre-conversion.
Oh, you were just like, you just don't mess with that.
I just had this, you know, and I think a lot of Catholics out there can relate to that. Even before their personal relationship with Christ started, they had this loyalty to what they knew, what they grew up with the church. Right. I remember there was a kid in class one time, and I was in an AP English class in high school, and he referenced something like what if Jesus was gay or something in class? And I got up in class, and I've had other Christians that were in my class that have since brought this up to me. Like, do you remember that time when Naveen said, what if Jesus was gay? And you got up and you picked him up out of his chair and said, don't ever say that again. Like, I don't know where that came from. That the deep-seated. So my point is that going through that experience kind of, you know, it kind of unearthed that sacramental grace that I had, you know, received, and also it made me aware of my need for a savior for the very first time. And then, you know, God, you know, I always think that God asked the Catholic Church to evangelize, and we don't do the best job of that. So he sends Protestants, and they do outreach a lot better than we do. And they reached out to me. And the only drawback of that experience, I say drawback now, but God had a plan, right? So they kind of after my conversion, kind of kicked out the Catholic foundation I had. I was kind of like, look, let's, all the religion stuff's not necessary. Let's just focus on the relationship.
So you turn your back on sacrament. You start thinking about, you know. So, you
I didn't go back to the Catholic Church for 12 years later.
You start thinking of something juridically and everything.
Yeah, 12 years later. I ended up transferring the next year out to Hawaii and going to Hope Chapel and New Hope Christian Fellowship. Really great evangelical churches who just love the Lord and wanted to worship him and bring people to Christ.
Right, yeah, and I'm a revert, so I get it too.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
from 18 to 24, and when I came back to the church, I was actually working in ministry, and so now you ended up in ministry, right?
Yeah, so I ended up going to ministry seminary at Fuller Seminary in California.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
and
they're doing some cool media stuff.
Worked at
right
Menlo
now.
Park Presbyterian by Stanford. And long story short, I ended up moving back home to Denver. I was engaged in my late 20s to a girl in San Francisco. It didn't work out. And so I waited an extra year, like just knew I needed to move home. So I moved home when I was 29 here to Denver and started to work at Pathways Church, which was a growing. So
I thought you were like 29, 30 years old. You know.
Thanks.
Good genes.
42,
I guess,
man.
Yeah.
Wrinkles are starting to show.
Yeah, I covered my wrinkles with this giant gray beard.
So then I ended up pastoring here, and that's where the whole story with Shapu comes in, because I was pastoring across the street from the cathedral downtown.
Yeah, so this is 90% of the reason, this and riffing on art is why I wanted you on the show, because this is like a great story. I've told this story to two or three people, and like this is a great story. So let's set the scene.
Okay.
You're pastoring a church in Denver.
Yep.
And it's close to
a block away.
It's a block
it's
17th away from the
in Pennsylvania, and then the cathedral's on 15th. And
yeah, so
Pearl,
it's a block away from the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception. And at that point, Archbishop Charles Chaput rhymes with slap you.
Chaput.
He is it Chaput or
Chaput?
Chaput or Chaput?
Chaput.
Chaput.
Yes.
Okay. Chaput. I know it rhymes with slap you because he told me it rhymes with slap you. So Archbishop Charles Chaput was. Pastoring, he was the Archbishop of Denver at the time, and you're right by the cathedral pastoring a Protestant church.
Growing, go. A couple thousand people. When we just bought a building, it's this old landmark Jewish temple that we bought for $1 million at Pathways. And so, things were looking up at Pathways. Church was growing. And as you know, a lot of these big evangelical churches are filled with former Catholics or fallen away Catholics, however you want to put it, right?
So ex-Catholic is the fastest growing denomination in America.
They say it's like 50%. So long story short, I was a bachelor at the time. I bought a house, was renting out a couple rooms to these younger Christian guys who had just relocated to Denver from Madison, Wisconsin. And they started going through a Catholic conversion before my eyes.
Hmm.
At the house, I start seeing all this Catholic literature and, you know, church fathers and Aquinas and
I didn't hear this part of the story.
Oh, yeah. So these are the guys that said, hey, we've been going to Sunday night mass at the cathedral, and we met the Archbishop. And I'm like, and? And they're like, and we told him all about you. I'm like, what'd you tell him? They're like, well, we told him that you grew up Catholic, but now that you're pastoring at Pathways across the street. And they're like, and he really wants to meet you. And I said, well, I can't meet him because I teach on Sunday nights at our own service.
Right.
He apparently has a service on Sunday nights. I'm like, you tell him if he wants to come and visit me at Pathways, he's welcome anytime, but I'm not going over there. So this went on for several weeks and months of them trying to convince me to come to the Sunday night mass to meet the Archbishop.
Yeah.
Because they were at the doorstep of the church waiting to, you know, they had been seeking more than I had.
Yeah.
The church fathers and the sacramental, you know, nature of the church. And so I sat Scott and Mark down, now Father Scott Jablonski. And Mark Lidonio, the director of evangelization for Madison.
This is Jablonski.
Yeah.
I went to the AI for a semester back in the day and was in class with Scott.
Yeah.
So this is Scott. Oh, I didn't know that.
Scott and Mark.
I didn't even hear this part of the story.
Yeah. Scott and Mark were friends back from Wisconsin. They both went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
That's hilarious.
So they basically, you know, I sat them down and said, guys, let me give you like 10 good reasons not even to consider becoming Catholic. I'm like, I was Catholic, and let me tell you why. Because there's always just a handful of barriers to entry for any evangelical
person,
you know, to become a Catholic. And so I went through my litany of you know, of everything, of why they shouldn't. And then they were so humble. I mean, part of the reason why I ended up going to Sunday Night Mass with them one night when I was off was because of how humble they were with, you know, because I felt older, I felt responsible, I felt like a spiritual director in some ways, especially being a pastor, and these young guys are in my house.
Yeah, so you're not their pastor.
No.
But you are a pastor.
Right. And they were coming to Pathways on occasion, but they kept doing the Catholic thing. And so they eventually coordinated a night for me to go and introduce me to the Archbishop after Mass. And he's always standing there at the back of the church, shaking everyone's hands. Yeah. And so I endured the Mass. I was totally, you know, had a chip on my shoulder.
Right, right.
And didn't genuflect, didn't get on my knees during the consecration.
Right.
I just sat there and just, you know, was kind of like, I don't need to do anything to earn the love of God. Like, I'm a child of God too. And all of this Catholic calisthenics is really unnecessary. So I kind of had this chip on my shoulder, and I go and meet the Archbishop. And this is, I mean, a paraphrase of what happened, but he basically just says, you know, he was kind of vetting me, like, were you really baptized? Were you really confirmed by Cardinal Stafford at Light of the World? Like, he knew these details somehow. I don't know if Scott and Mark told him or I said, yeah, I was confirmed by Cardinal Stafford. And well, he's like, well, don't you know that you're a Catholic and that you're leading people out of the church? And I was like, well, he said you're across the street, and you know, a lot of Catholics were visiting or whatever. And I just said, well, the sheep are going to go where they get fed.
Yeah,
you know, right. Maybe you're not doing something right. And, you know, he just kind of looked at me a little surprised, and he was like, well, I'm kind of want to learn what your issues are, and would you feel comfortable coming over my house and talking about that? And I said, no, I wouldn't feel comfortable, you know? And so I kind of shook his hand and said, thanks, you know, and turned to leave. And it was a real moment of grace when I felt his hand on my shoulder. And I stopped and turned around, and something in his disposition changed from coming at me like a bit of a bulldog to more a much more humble pastoral approach. And he said, would you meet me at Starbucks? And I just couldn't turn him down. I said, yeah, I'll meet you at Starbucks. So I met him at Starbucks, and we met for 3 hours. And then 5 months later, I had to quit my job as a pastor.
I often joke, I'm from Missouri, and I often joke that the real motto, instead of show me, should be, the real motto of Missouri should be, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And I like my version of your story better, which I had remembered it and told it basically like that.
Yeah.
But without all the precursor of Jablonski and all that, I had Archbishop Shapu walking into your church and saying, you're stealing sheep. And he's like, well, they're going to go where they're going to get fed. You have lunch with me? No. You know, that's it. But I thought that like, he like came to you and like challenged you or something.
No.
Because I could see him doing that.
Oh, he did. I mean, he did challenge me. I mean, that 5 months I met with him frequently at his residence, and we drank a lot of beer and had a lot of wine and smoked a lot of cigars and opened a lot of books. And, you know, I came at him with everything I had in terms of why I shouldn't become a Catholic.
Dude, that guy is a real pastor.
Do we have time? I mean, there's one short little thing that he did in those meetings, and that was when he asked me for forgiveness. That went so far.
Yeah.
He said, as bishops, we have failed your generation. He knew I was raised in the church. He knew I went to youth group. He knew those things. And when he asked me for forgiveness, I just, you know, and then he laid out for me what the church teaches as opposed to just the sinful practice in the church.
Wow.
There's teaching and practice. And he owned all the sinful practice and asked me for forgiveness.
that is so key.
That did so much for me to get me there.
We really, you know, we get in this weird place where it's like, it's either bulldog apologetics and don't admit any weakness,
right,
or you don't really believe in it. And that is such BS. And it's put so many people off.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like he did the right thing.
Yeah. So super pastoral, and that's kind of the journey, you know? And then I just, you know, I remember stressed out because I had a mortgage, I had a car payment, you know, it was my livelihood, which is a big reason why a lot of these evangelical guys don't look to the Catholic Church. Cause I'm like, you know, you've heard my story, you know, I can't be a priest, you know, with my particular struggles sexually and different things. And he, you know, he just said, you know, I said, what am I going to do? And he just said, number one, you're going to trust God. And number two, I know a lot of people in this town, and I think you'd be a good fit in their organization. So that's how I got to Focus.
Well, there you go. And then with that note, we're going to go to the break, and we'll be right back with Jeremy Rivera.
Then how we crave a hanging in his dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
People singing, please don't sting, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, and you are listening to Breadbox Media. All right, so we're here with Jeremy Rivera. When we left our hero, he was coming back into the Catholic Church after being boldly challenged by the force to be reckoned with that is Archbishop Charles Chaput. And you ended up at Focus.
Yeah.
So Focus, years is this?
This was 2006. So I came back to the church, and he said, you've already received confirmation. You don't need to go through RCIA. You just need to have a general confession, which was like an hour and a half or something. and then you can just start coming back to Mass. So that was January 2006.
All my Protestant friends that are Catholic, I'm like, man, you're just one confession away. Come on.
Right.
Come on in. The water's fine.
Yeah.
You're one confession away.
So talk about a steep learning curve. There's no more, Focus is just a great organization with really incredible, well-formed people. And I was kind of definitely a maverick or kind of a, didn't really fit the mold, if you will. Yeah. But, I mean, it was a great place to learn about, how to be Catholic and how to have a devotion to God, going to daily Mass and praying a rosary. And that was definitely a process for me, which is why I first started with Focus, they wanted, Archbishop's vision was for me to jump right into leadership. And I said, I just want to be a missionary and start on the bottom. I want to just learn how to be Catholic.
Right.
So, as Providence would have it, it was so late in their hiring season. It was like May, which is the very end of when they hire people for the next fall, because they have summer training over the summer, that they didn't have hardly any positions for a male missionary at the time. And I remember being at their office and they said, and this is when I knew God was so in this, is they said, we've only got one spot for a male missionary, and that's CU Boulder. And you just think about how thorough God is. You've heard that God never wastes a hurt. What I mean? That he wants to restore the years the locust has eaten. Well, that one year, my freshman year, with all of that debauchery, basically, God sends me back clear-minded, sober in spirit, and as a Focus missionary back to CU for 1 year. And that was just a gift. And God, I got to go back to all those same places and pray over them and find a lot of healing and reconciliation.
Wow. That is...
Providential.
That's super providential. I love when God does this,
weaves it back through, and you're like, oh, I'm not on this totally like random,
right? No, it is. Like when something happens, and you're like, wait a minute, and this, that's not a coincidence, So, so you ended up being the marketing director for Focus.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's interesting. So now, had you done the marketing thing before?
I studied business and had always been real creative, ever since I was a kid, and especially with video production, I was always splicing videos together. And as an evangelical pastor, I would use videos in my sermons as support, to support points and complement the message. And so I always had this creative bone in my body to want to be, to express, what we were all about in a cool way. And so I found my lane. They had a PR need initially. I started in public relations with Focus, and then that turned into the director of marketing and then a national director, and I built a team and rebranded Focus and all of that. Just had some great people working with me. And so, and then I had a great mentor there as well. Our chairman of the board, Mark Coller, is a former Procter & Gamble marketing executive. He was president of P&G. So he basically took me under his wing and taught me everything that he knew about marketing. And that was a great opportunity, kind of an informal grad school.
And so now how did you end up breaking out and doing your own thing?
Having kids, just expensive and cost of living. And when you're working in a nonprofit, that's a challenge to make ends meet. So on a hike one day of just grumbling to God, he was kind of like, why don't you do something about it? In my own heart of faith, it was kind of like, start your own thing. You're entrepreneurial. You've done this before.
Right.
Just lose the net underneath the trapeze, kind of, like going out on your own. Mm-hmm. So I started Little J, and I'm in my fifth year now.
This is big upside, but no net.
Right.
It's rough,
Yeah, but I love the freedom, flexibility, being home with my kids when I need to be.
This makes sense to me, too, because I need to look this up. Who is it? It's either Carl Bernstein or who's the guy that wrote the book on JP2, not Weigel, but the guy Woodward and Bernstein that broke the whole, Nixon and all that. One of those two, I think it's Carl Bernstein. One of two, Bob Woodward or Carl Bernstein, one or the other. I keep forgetting. I always do this. I need to look this up. I'll look it up during the break. And well, so he just wrote a book. One of the one of those guys was, he just wrote a book about the history of American religion, and he classifies it as institutional religion, and that's the Catholics and kind of like high church Anglicans and all mm-hmm. that, and then movement religion, which is kind of holiness, Pentecostal, Methodism, some of these movements, right? And then he brands evangelicals and kind of charismatics and like the emergent church as entrepreneurial religion.
Hmm.
And when you think about it, it's you do a focus group or you look at your market and then you build, you sculpt your message in a way that they'll be understood and will hit home with them. It's like the listener, the target comes first,
right?
You know, and then you have your brand and you have the before the brand. And but before you start talking, you think about who you're talking to.
A lot of consumer research.
Right. And so it makes perfect sense.
It reveals a lot of insights, which is the key to winning in business or ministry.
Yeah. So it's like, it makes sense to me that someone who is a Protestant pastor
yeah.
would right. come into the church and then find their way to the part that we don't do very well, which is the design and branding and all that. So let's talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. I think art is just something that, our world is so in need of more art and artists. And, I was thinking the other day about something Picasso said. He said that good taste is the enemy of great art. And I love that, because when you think about it, like, good taste has everything to do with, you know, being cultured and being refined and being very civil.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that good taste is the enemy of great art, it's like when you look at the Bible, you know, a lot of the best characters aren't very refined or cultured or, they're wild. And mm-hmm. and I think that God is too, you know. And for me, that comes down to just, you know, people always say, like, you know, smile, God loves you kind of thing. Like, God loves everybody. Theologically, right. Like, God has to love us, right?
He is love.
That doesn't make us special. It just means that God doesn't have any taste.
No, you're right. You're special and different and unique, just like everyone
right,
else.
Right. And that's the point, is that you know, and Rich Mullins was fond of saying this. He's like, you know, and I don't think God does have any taste. And thank God for that, right? Because he has the ability to take the message.
He was in RCIA when he got killed.
I think he actually went through RCIA, decided against it, but was on his way to receiving communion when he died.
Oh.
That's what the priest on record is. There's a letter.
Really?
Rich called him and said, I have to. He'd already been through RCIA and decided he wasn't ready.
Hmm.
In Arizona and all of that. But then he was on the road, and he was just so desperate for the body and blood of Christ that he called his priest friend in Illinois and said, I have to do it. And that's when he was killed on his way there.
Oh my gosh. I had no idea.
There's a letter online about it from the priest who got the phone call from Rich.
We could do a whole podcast about Rich Mullins.
And we should. Yeah. But my point is that Rich's point was that he's glad God doesn't have any taste, because then now God's able to take the mess of our lives and turn it into something beautiful.
Right.
You know? And
what's that T.S. Eliot quote about success is the... success is what you can make from the mess you've made of things.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's what God does.
I mean, and I think sometimes we do that to God, right? We want God to be more civil and more cultured and more refined. But if he was, he would be no good to Christianity. Because right. It all starts with being aware of your need for a savior. Like me in right. the dorm room at 19, having got a girl pregnant. Like, and some of the other, you know, crazy, you know, stories that I have where I've places that I've put myself, you know,
right.
It's like, you know, thank God for, the people that he sends us and the wild things that he does. So
I think that beyond art in general, but branding, design, mm-hmm. it's my contention that, that design is to the moderns what rhetoric was to the ancients. Because we are a primarily visual culture, where they were primarily an oral culture.
Right.
And where we in some ways in the Catholic Church, and in some ways for a while there in the Protestant Church, we were still so much focused on what we say and how we say it.
Mm-hmm.
But now, especially and increasingly like to 11 now with the digital media and everything, we are an increasingly visual culture.
Right. And that's why beauty of right. all the transcendentals, right? Like it's beauty is that thing that I think I've heard a lot of people talking about recently, that we need to reach Absolutely. People through beauty, not so much truth or even goodness, but beauty. And then through the doorway of beauty, we can lead them to the truth.
Look, I think Aquinas says that the beauty is the visible form of the good. Yeah. So if you want to get them to the good, I mean, the way we kind of lead with the good is, I mean, the truth is kind of relative and nobody wants to listen to the truth. And the people who don't think the truth is relative are the ones who kind of are so kind of so objective that they don't have any wonder left.
Right.
And then people don't listen. And then the good, the way we lead with the good is we got this moral ruler and we hold it up to them that they didn't sign up to be measured by this. And they're like, oh, you're gay. You don't measure up. Right. Oh, you're this, you don't measure up. Oh, you're measuring. I'm
divorced.
You're whatever. Divorced. Or you're whatever. But the beauty, people haven't been inoculated to the beauty completely.
Right. So, yeah. So the art, you know, and the branding, by the way, for me, branding is not a logo, right? There's a misconception out there. Like, oh, do our branding. You know, branding is delivering on a promise. That's what branding is. So when you talk about building brand equity as a company, you know, you're basically, you have to have one happy client at a time. You have to do what you say you're going to do well. That's brand equity. See, okay. Because equity is either going up or down. So branding is really having a brand promise, you know, and then delivering against that consistently. That's a brand.
Let's pick that up after the break because we have to go to the break. But that's fascinating. All right, so you're listening to The Counter Position. I'm here with Jeremy Rivera. We'll be back for the final lap in a second.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley, and we are here with Jeremy Rivera of Little J, and we're talking about branding, about God's taste and bad taste. A friend of mine says, oh, that's just another example of my taste and bad taste. We're talking about how, thank God, God doesn't have good taste because he wouldn't love us. But, and we're talking about branding and delivering brand equity. And that's what we were talking about when we went to the break, is delivering on a promise over and over again. And that's interesting because in some ways that's what God does with us, is he delivers on that promise over and over again. And when we really show up and we really give ourselves to the process, we get the results that he promised.
Yeah. I never thought of this before, but I think Scott Hahn has a book titled A Father Who Never Breaks His Promises or something like that. Yeah. So that's, you know, God's brand equity. And if God had a logo, it would be the crucifix, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he leads with, is the most broken, painful time in his life, right? Which is the most powerful moment of his life.
Yeah.
Think about that. That's pretty powerful for us as Christians.
And it's funny. I just heard someone talking about this the other day. I can't remember. I'd give him props if I could remember who it was. But so look at Islam. Someone makes a bad cartoon of Muhammad or something, and then whole countries break out into violence and freak out. And because you've insulted or you've humiliated our prophet, and now you're going to die or whatever. You say, Christians, our God literally became man, let himself be completely humiliated and die. And we lead with that.
Yeah.
We put it on a t-shirt. We stick it on a crucifix on the wall. We put it on our church. We lead with God humiliated, God defeated, God beaten, because we know that that's where the victory was.
Right. Amen.
Right. We lead with that as opposed to, so then how do you use, how do you use things like a logo, video, visual images?
So I would say that's like your visual identity rather than just branding, right? I mean, you think of like the most powerful brands in the world, like Nike, right? Everyone knows the Nike symbol with the swoosh,
right?
And just do it, right? And Apple, right? I mean, and Target and whatever the, you know, Disney, and you could go Starbucks, on and on, the most powerful brands in the world. What's the church's visual identity, right? It's the crucifix. And if I had my druthers, you know what the tagline of the Catholic Church would be?
What would it be?
Just come home.
Just come home.
Just come home. It's the prodigal. It's, he was not met with a whole bunch of questions.
Right.
He was not met with, you know, I mean, he had just spent his inheritance on prostitutes and riotous living and debauchery. And
right.
My point is that he was met with, the only time you'll ever see God in a hurry, ever, in any of the parables, is when he's running to his son
who
decided to come home. He had that metanoia, that change of mind. He came to his senses and headed for the Father's home. And that's where you see, as soon as the Father sees him, he girds his loins and runs to his son, falls on his neck, kisses him over and over, it says, read it in the Greek, puts the ring on his finger, puts the robe around him, right? This son of mine that was lost is found. He was dead, now he's alive again.
Because
if the church had that kind of a love, and I know it does, right?
Right.
But if the church's members have that kind of a love for the lost, just come home. We're not gonna ask what your cholesterol is on the battlefield, like Pope Francis said.
Right.
We're not gonna check your blood pressure.
It's triage.
When you've got to heal the wounds.
Yeah.
We'll work on that later. I think somewhere that's where I struggle, because I don't know whether the middle ground is for people to come home. They're met with, well, can they receive communion? Or what, they're divorced and remarried. They're
right.
Like, we start to make these judgments, and I'm not saying that I know what the right thing to do is there, but I am saying these people just need a place to come and be loved and be heard that they're loved.
Right.
And that's the only thing that's going to change anyone's behavior anyway.
We have to embody God.
Is love.
We have to embody God. And I think that if we looked at the Father that's embodied in the scripture there versus us, we would have embraced and kissed the older boy that stayed at home. But here, let's look at this. Real fatherhood, what draws real fatherhood out of itself and makes it become more itself and makes it run like that is sonship. Now, the prodigal was a crappy son, but he was a son. The older boy was good, but he was a good slave. He wasn't a son. And he damns himself in the scripture. He says, you do all this for him. You never gave me as much as a goat to feast on with my friends. And we just saw the heart of this father. He gave him half and then took him back. And if he never got a goat out of the old man, it's because he never asked. He damns himself. He never asked. No. He saw himself as a dutiful slave.
Right. And I think it's interesting that Jesus leaves it open-ended. Like, we don't know if the older brother actually comes in and joins the party or not.
Right.
Like, the Pharisees or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? Like, some came across and some didn't.
In that position.
Yeah. And I always like to think that after the party, after they killed the fatted calf and had a party, I always wanted to write a poem or a short story on the day after the party.
Yeah.
Where the father kind of goes to his prodigal son and he says, son, help me grab that broom over there. Help me clean up.
Yeah.
He puts him to work. Like, now we got to get going, you know?
Yeah, now we got to do something. That's the church,
right? We love you as you are, but we love you too much to leave you that way.
Exactly.
Right? So now we got to get going. Now we got to pursue the life of
a particularly good piece of visual in here in Denver. You know Dave Hazen, right?
Yeah.
You're friends with Dave, I'm sure. He did that. He did a campaign over there at the diocese when he was still here for Lent 1 year. And it was just a shot of the confessional with the green light on above the confessional, and it said, we'll leave the light on for you.
Oh, that's great.
It's like, that's amazing. But it's, come on.
Yeah.
Just come.
Right.
Just come. But
Just come home.
I think that the idea, because we have presented Catholicism and Christianity in general as a moral project.
Yeah.
It's about, in the West, it's about becoming good.
Well, then I'm out.
Right.
I fail. I don't qualify.
Good. And so if you are not good now and you're not ready to just immediately give up everything and become good, then you shouldn't be in our project, because this is the Be Good Project.
Right.
Whereas in the East, this is kind of why I've been slanting Byzantine more here lately, is like in the East, it's not about becoming good. It's about becoming God. That deification, that theosis, they call it, that being a partaker of divine nature and being slowly transformed and taken up into something other than yourself that is the other, the great other, right? And it's like if you were like, hey, man, just come. Just come be part of this. We accept, we take you however you are. Now we're now the issue of communion comes in and all that. Okay, but ultimately, are we going to pretend that we have a unity that we don't have? Maybe not. But if we present that, that's branding. We need to figure out how to brand the fact. Yeah. We need to figure out how to brand communion so they don't look like it's something that works.
Yeah, and I think what scares people, what scares people who are, I don't know if conservative is the right word, or they would consider themselves orthodox, or I think what scares them is that it's a license to sin,
right?
That it's, you know, it's not, and I hope anyone who hears this isn't hearing me say that, because it's certainly not a license to sin. You know, Paul's very clear about that. Shall we sin to let grace abound? By all means, no. But
well, he's
but
forgiven much, loves much.
We have to start where we are, right? We have to meet people where they're at. And
right.
We can't ask people to go clean themselves up before they jump into the shower. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
We need to just come home and get
the shower,
cleansed.
The hospital. Yes. These are the images that we,
especially
the Pope keeps using. And we look at it as like, no, it's this thing that you have to earn, mm-hmm. that you have to get in, that you have
right.
to, but it's like, and then now they're on the other side, people leave the church. Any Catholic church, any Christian church, and they go, oh, there's a bunch of hypocrites there. But that's like saying, yeah, I left the gym. There was fat people there.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's why they're at the gym. Right. It's because they don't want to be fat.
And we
anymore.
Preach perfection, and none of us have attained that, so I guess we're all hypocrites.
Exactly.
Right?
So, God have mercy on us all. I'll tell you what.
You just can't have it both ways, though. Like, when the Holy Spirit moves in the Gospels, like, crazy stuff happens.
Right.
Right? Every miracle began with a problem. When you pray in your parish for the Holy Spirit to move or to become a more evangelistic parish,
right.
it's going to get messy. And you can't have it both ways. You can't have your prim and proper, perfect everything in the liturgy and mass and, you know, and have these people coming back to God without a mess.
Right.
Dead bodies came out of the grave when the Spirit moved, when Jesus walked.
Well, that's unseemly.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Right? So, I mean, that's where we just got to try to withhold our judgment, our own personal lens that we have, pray for that conversion of hearts and souls, and it is going to get messy. You know, people are going to come forward with their problems, with the
right.
abortions that they've had, with the divorces they've been through, with the adultery they've committed.
Right.
With, you know, that's life. And please tell me the church can handle that, because that's, you know, last I checked, God so loved the world, you know.
We can end with what we started with. If to imitate God, to love with the love of God, is while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us.
Mm.
While we were yet sinners, you have to love people in their sin. Love
right.
goes first.
Right.
Love comes before it all. So, and with that, okay, let's, Little J, where can we find Little J at?
TheLittleJ.com.
TheLittleJ.com. If you want some branding help or whatever, and any cool projects you got coming out?
Yeah, I've got a documentary coming out on St. Patrick's Day on the life of St. Patrick that I produced with EWTN.
Wow,
so
nice.
So they hired me to produce this, and we shot it on location, obviously, in Ireland and in England at Oxford and Trinity College, and it's really, really cool.
And when's that going to be on?
That'll be on March 15th and March 17th.
Is it going to be available like on video for download?
I think it's on EWTN streaming, you know, like online.
Yeah.
But it'll also be on primetime on their network.
Cool. Right on. Well, you know what? I get people on here every once in a while. Like McCusker comes on here mm-hmm. and different people. And it's like, dude, I could have you on once a week. Like you could be a co-host on Thursdays. I mean, it's like good conversation. Just really... I love when I find people who kind of like get it, but they get it in a slightly different way so that like pings back and forth. Spectacular fun. But
thanks for having me.
Yeah,
man.
Thanks so much for coming on, Jeremy. All right, so this is Jeremy Rivera of The Little J, thelittlej.com. Watch on 15th and 17th on EWTN for the St. Patrick's documentary. And that's it for the day. So let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out, kids.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.